European leaders hold an emergency meeting in Paris as the U.S. appears to pull back from the alliance and moves toward Russia.
Now we are in this generational point, really, where we do need to step up across Europe in terms of our capability, our funding, and our commitment to defense.
Just how big a shift in the world order is this?
I would characterize it, and I use this term, I don't use this term lightly, as seismic. I think it's really a seismic shift.
Today is Monday, February 17th, and this is The Issue from VOA.
I'm Scott Walterman.
Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London.
We're facing a generational challenge when it comes to national security.
British Prime Minister Keir Starmer on Monday saying that it was crucial for all of Europe to spend more on defense, saying that just before attending a crisis meeting in Paris called by French President Emmanuel Macron to discuss a potential European future with a diminished U.S. participation.
We do need to step up across Europe in terms of our capability, our funding, and our commitment to defense, because this isn't just about Ukraine. It is about our own national security. And that's why my message will be that we've all got to step up across Europe.
The Paris meeting came after a blizzard of diplomatic interventions by Washington that have raised doubts over U.S. commitment to the transatlantic alliance, the bedrock of European security.
Macron invited leaders from Germany, Britain, Poland, Spain, the Netherlands, and Denmark, which represented Baltic and Scandinavian countries for the occasion, along with the European Union leadership and the NATO Secretary General.
U.S. President Donald Trump stunned European allies in NATO and Ukraine last week when he announced that he had talked with Russian President Vladimir Putin without consulting them and would start a peace process.
Ulf Kristersson, Prime Minister of Sweden, said his country would consider contributing to post-war peacekeeping forces in Ukraine, adding that negotiations would need to progress before any such decision was taken.
There are very good reasons for European countries to be as aligned as possible. We are firmly behind Ukraine. Every talk about Ukraine must be together with Ukraine, of course. And since we're talking about the security infrastructure in Europe, the European voice is also important. So Denmark is representing the five Nordic and the three Baltic countries on those discussions this afternoon.
Now, while all of this was happening, the Kremlin said senior American and Russian officials will hold talks on improving their ties and negotiating an end to the war in Ukraine. It would be the most significant meeting between the sides since Moscow's full-scale invasion of Ukraine nearly 3 years ago. The talks are scheduled for Tuesday in Saudi Arabia.
Let's get some insights now on the Trump administration's shift in U.S. policy when it comes to Russia and Europe.
Joining us is Michael Butler, Associate Professor of International Relations and Chair of the Department of Political Science at Clark University.
Well, first off, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
What does this say for U.S. diplomatic and national security policy going forward?
So I think I would characterize it, and I use this term, I don't use this term lightly, as seismic. I think it's really a seismic shift, away from maybe a guiding premise that alliances and some commitment to liberal democracy is a guiding principle of U.S. foreign policy and U.S. foreign relations, towards a cultivation and the celebration of power politics, and really a kind of return of realpolitik and a cultivation of spheres of influence, in which the United States would certainly carve out a sizable one, but would be willing to maybe concede the same to Russia, China, and other great powers.
He does seem to be eschewing these traditional relationships for this as you describe it, power politics sphere of the United States, China, and Russia right now are the only ones that matter to make a deal with.
Yeah, I think, I think it's emblematic of the administration's transactional view of politics and of, in this case, diplomacy. The idea that diplomacy is entirely a zero-sum proposition, and that, as you said, the only credible partners or the only viable adversaries would be ones of equivalent power. Smaller states, with less global reach and impact and less military power would be considered sort of second tier and not really viable partners or equal partners in the diplomatic exchange.
The Americans, if the Americans are negotiating with Russia to end the war in Ukraine without the president of Ukraine or Europeans, at least for now, but the U.S. is also saying Europe alone has to be ultimately responsible for enforcing security and guaranteeing and paying for any agreement. What does that tell you?
That tells me that the U.S. Shift towards power politics or realpolitik is sort of a immature one, in that it doesn't really recognize realities, strategic realities. I mean, it seems it's something of a pipe dream that the Europeans would be cut out of any discussions about the future of Ukraine and then be expected or be willing to foot the bill for some kind of post-agreement stabilization force or peacekeepers or what have you. I can't envision or understand in any way why European leaders would accept that arrangement. And I don't think they will.
Well, they're meeting today. French President Macron called a meeting of some of the states in Europe, I would say EU, but England is there, Great Britain is there, and they're not in the EU anymore. All of the states that he called to Paris to meet are NATO members. Isn't the meeting itself sort of that message? Like, we're sending a message that we're consulting with each other on our next move in this regard.
Yeah, I think in some ways, the meeting today could be characterized as an attempt at, rethinking NATO leadership without the U.S. Or recalibrating, redefining a NATO without the U.S. Being in a leadership position, maybe is a better way of putting it. So it's certainly reflective of the Europeans coming to terms with, this changing reality that President Zelensky referred to over the weekend as, the old days are over and America's not supporting Europe anymore just because it always did in the past. I think this is something that was clearly understood not only by Zelensky, but by some of the, Eastern members of the EU and NATO, Poland, the Baltic states, Finland. And it's maybe something that Western Europeans are really starting to wake up to. And I think Munich was really a slap in the face in that regard and a wake-up call in that regard.
Would you call this a transatlantic alliance potentially in crisis?
Yeah, I don't think there's any other way to think of it, because it's pretty clear that the U.S. has said it's no longer prioritizing a role as a guarantor of European security. It's not only not engaging in good faith with the Europeans about something that's vital to them, which is the future of Ukraine and the Russia-Ukraine war. But it's also taking the opportunity to do that, and instead of doing so, actually interfering in domestic politics in places like Germany. So I don't think there's any other way to view it from the European side. But as a crisis point, NATO has been through other crisis points in the past, and has, you know, kind of managed to recalibrate and stabilize and muddle through those crisis points. But I think this one is much more significant and qualitatively different from any of those.
You know, the United States has always sort of carried NATO with the concept of war breaks out, it's better there than here. But they're backing away from that, saying, you guys are going to have to foot the bill. We have other things on the planet to deal with. China, for example, and the Pacific. Is there an optimistic way to look at this?
Well, so the issue of burden sharing and the inequality of burden sharing in NATO is pretty much one that dates to its formation. And there have been lots of U.S. administrations, I think beginning with Eisenhower going forward, who made this point that, you know, the Europeans need to carry more of the burden of their own defense. And it was really only when Trump's first term that began to transcend rhetoric and start to enter into the realm of policy, where the administration really started to try to hold Europeans, feet to the fire on this point. And it actually did lead to shifts. I mean, the percentage of GDP spent on defense in a number of European countries has increased over the last 5 to 10 years. And as I mentioned, Poland and Finland and the Baltic states are kind of leading the way in that regard, given their proximity to Russia. I don't know if it's optimism, but from the European side, this is it's been a long-standing discussion about, you know, can and will Europe really develop a common defense force? And there have been fits and starts along the way, and this may be the moment from the European side where they have all come to realize there's no alternative. So, whether Europe building up its military and defense capabilities is optimistic or not, from the standpoint of global peace and security, that's a debatable proposition. But from the standpoint of European citizens feeling that their own countries are taking a greater role in maintaining their own national defense, this is a significant shift.
What are the downsides?
Well, I mean, it means a reallocation of resources in European countries towards security and defense. It means putting, more European soldiers in, you know, risky and potentially dangerous position if they were to be some sort of stabilization force to uphold an agreement, you know, a ceasefire in Ukraine, that will be a lot more risk and a lot more burden being born. And I know that the UK has not ruled it out. Sweden has not ruled it out. Conversely, Germany and Spain have said it's premature to even talk about such a thing right now, because it takes the focus off of the fact that the Europeans seem to be getting cut out of the negotiations about the future of the war. So, there's a lot at stake,
What are the downsides for the U.S. too?
Downsides for the U.S. The U.S. will be, losing, gradually, perhaps, but losing support from, you know, many of its strongest allies and its longest standing allies. A group of states that have stood by the United States. I mean, let's not forget that, the first time that Article 5 of NATO was invoked, it was over Afghanistan, and many of these same member states sent forces to Afghanistan to support the United States, after 9/11. So, the U.S. is, really, stands to lose a lot in terms of these longstanding, trustworthy security partners and economic partners, and entering a much riskier landscape in which, it may be seeking to broker or engage in deals with regimes like Russia and China, which are far less reliable and, of course, far less you know, historically, not at all in alignment.
I read an article talking exactly what you're saying. So there's sort of a new Cold War between the United States and China now. China, by some measure, it matches the U.S. economy, certainly has many, many more people in it. And the equalizer for the United States was the fact that you could count the entirety of the European alliance on our side, combined together with us, gave us, you know, just that much more to combat this growing China influence. This is sort of a gamble, right? Like you said, if Europe starts to pull away and we find ourselves against an alignment of Russia, China, North Korea alone, it's hard to see how we come out the other side.
Yeah, I mean, it's an important point to recognize that, economic and security issues are thoroughly intertwined. And in fact, you know, U.S. national security depends heavily on as any country's does, on a, you know, well-functioning, robust, productive economy with, you know, viable trade partners that are, you know, trustworthy for both imports and exports. And so there's a lot at stake here in the economic arena as well. And I think it's important to remember that Europe as a collective, the European Union, as well as all of its member states, has agency. If they are sidelined and cut out of this arrangement going forward, they would have no choice but to consider, you know, where they fit in a new realignment and to do business, more business with China, perhaps, than they already are. One would be left to conclude that in some ways the U.S. sort of pushed them in that direction. And that seems to be if the bigger, longer term, concern for U.S. national security is its, put it mildly, its rivalry with China. I don't see where pushing Europe into China's arms would be of benefit to the U.S.
We really appreciate your insights. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
That was Michael Butler, Associate Professor of International Relations and Chair of the Department of Political Science at Clark University.
You've been listening to The Issue from The Voice of America.
For news throughout the day, check out our website, voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Lori London.
And I'm Scott Walterman.
We'll talk to you tomorrow.